Purdue Marshall Show, reminding you that two thongs still don't make it right.
All right, folks, look, I want to mention to you a couple things. Something's got to give. Ray Donovan, Numbers, Criminal Minds, The Closer, Faceless, Ladies Night, Third Watch, Total Cops, The Streets of San Francisco, Sixth Sense, Walton's, Kojak, and The Rockford Files are just a few things you may have seen him in, but playing Detective David Starsky is what got him his own hunk poster back in the 70s, because it certainly wasn't when he was on The Streets of San Francisco. Ladies and gentlemen, Paul Michael Glazer.
How are you?
I'm well. Listen, I have some riveting questions to ask you, and I want to start off with the biggest one. Bruins or Kings?
Oh, that's not even a question. Come on.
Well, I don't know. You live in the Kings. You're from the Bruins. Which one?
Bruins.
Okay. Good answer, by the way. Paul, look, I was sitting around the house one day eating Pop-Tarts and getting fat, and I was watching Oprah, and your face was on the television screen, and I thought, man, that's an interesting guy. I wonder what's going on with him. And holy jumping, what a life. I had no idea. Sorry, I'm not a creeper. I haven't been tracking you for 30 years. So I don't know. I just kind of felt I really wanted to have you on the show. So thank you for spending some time with us today.
Oh, please. My pleasure.
You seem so bored in most of the interviews I've watched while doing my research. And I want to know if this quote has anything to do with it. People create their gods in order to eat them. Then when you meet this god, you want an autograph, you want a photograph, a shake a hand, a hug. What you're doing in psychological terms is trying to get a piece of that part of the person that's a god for yourself. When you're a celebrity, what you encounter with people is their agendas, which oftentimes have nothing to do with who you are. Do you think that quote has anything to do with, I don't know, a perceived apathy in these interviews? Or are you just the most laid-back cat on the planet?
Oh, I'm not the most laid-back cat on the planet. If there's something to talk about that's interesting, then I'm probably more animated. Interviews are a strange thing, you know, and so much of it has to do with the chemistry and the questions asked and time of day.
Right.
Well, thanks.
Well, look, obviously, I mean, I want to talk about things that are important to you. I have my own agenda as well, but still very important to you is your first wife, Elizabeth, and your daughter, Ariel. Obviously, you know, the rest of your family, but those I would say would be your biggest losses, obviously. So let's talk right off the bat about your book, Crystallia and the Source of Light. If I get this right, it's about faith, hope, and fear. It's about a 14-year-old girl or 9-year-old brother. Their mom is dying. The girl is disillusioned with everything in life. Doesn't believe anything she can't see or touch. And then
they take a journey to an underground medieval kingdom where everything and everybody are made of minerals and crystals in search of the source of light. I also did a recorded version, which is on Amazon along with the book.
So this book intrigues me because, you know, on the surface, it seems like, you know, it would be right beside Eckhart Tolle's material. It would be sold at the Mind, Body, Spirit festivals. It has to do with crystals and minerals and light and utopia, and I mean, what can you just peel back a few layers on this? Because I mean, first of all, it's a children's book, but it's way more than just a children's book. I mean, it's this,
right?
Any real big person could totally get a stoke out of this as well, right?
Right. I'll try. I wanted to write to the child in all of us, okay? In this day and age, people in the, have a tendency, and we've kind of been trained to for it by Madison Avenue, trained to categorize things and need to put them in a category. Well, who's this for? Is this for this age group or that age group? And I kind of resisted that, and I just said, no, I have to write to the child and all of us. And when I first wrote this, I wrote it as a screenplay, this is about 14 years ago. But at the time, there was no technology for animating the properties of light. thanks to Mr. Cameron, that has changed. But in the meantime, I thought I'd write a book. I thought probably have a little more imprimatur as a book. I thought that I'd never written a book. That would be an interesting thing to do. And when I took a look at it and started studying it, I realized, you know, when you create stuff, when you create stuff, whether it be a picture or a story or whatever, oftentimes you find yourself standing back and looking at it and going, oh my gosh, look what just came out of me.
Hmm.
And I realized that Crystallia was, in a lot of ways, my attempt to share with people what I'd learned about loss and helplessness. And that became my objective as I wrote the book and filled it out. And I wanted to make it as entertaining as possible, because a lot of these books are, that have to do with enlightenment and mindfulness and compassion and helplessness and loss, they can get kind of either dry or, you know, that there's nothing there. And I'm a storyteller. I love telling stories. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to tell a kind of Alice in Wonderland, Wizard of Oz kind of story. I'm going to attempt to write in the classic vein, a story that people will want to take down from the shelf every Christmas and read aloud to and with each other, the families. So I created these characters in this world underground. They all have different accents. I phoneticized the accents so that when you read the book out loud, you end up speaking with a Japanese accent or French or German or whatever. I also, you know, took a world that I had always liked as a kid, and that was the world of minerals and crystals. And what I discovered was that underground, any shape, color, hue, texture that you could possibly make up in your mind, just imagine, already exists. And that underground, that world is a world that we know very little of. You know, you say to somebody, crystals, they think, oh, my local rock shop, I'll get quartz, I'll get amethyst, I'll get citrine, I'll get a few fossils. But it's far more complex and far different, and a living world, if you will.
Oh, listen, I over the years, have done a lot of spelunking and have been... Mm-hmm. Been very, very deep underground, whether it be in the Mammoth Caves in California, caves in California, caves in Jamaica, caves in Australia, and exactly what you're saying is so true. Anything you can imagine and more is down there.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. And so I figure, well, that's really cool. Mm. And then I created all these characters, and I decided to have the light come from inside them. Because all the facets and crystals, all of the, all the angles of the geometric shapes, those facet lines, if I had light traveling down them, then the characters lit from inside would function also like a mood ring might, and you get all these different, so you can portray all kinds of emotions and everything. And so that became very exciting. And The key thing was, though, that I have experienced in my life, a fair amount of loss and helplessness, as you said, and I've been very fortunate. I've been extremely fortunate because I have been exposed to teachings and I've been guided by teachers, and I have learned how to make the choice between being a victim or finding the opportunity in a situation.
These teachers, I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, I met people who exposed me. I had a fellow who is still my teacher, and he exposed me to that whole world of mindfulness and awareness, and I started reading and studying, and what I discovered was a very essential nugget of information or knowledge, if you will, which has to do with fear and how we deal with fear. And actually, at the heart of the book, while it doesn't say the words literally, it asks the question, what is the purpose of fear in our lives? And so what I discovered and what I try to share with people is that oftentimes when we describe what we're feeling, we say, I am scared, right? I am scared. I am sad. I am this. I am that. That's not really what we mean, because that's not who we are. That's not what we are. What we mean is that a part of us is scared. There's a part that's scared. And if we look, we can see a part that's not scared, even if it's our little finger or the tip of our nose. And that raises the question, well, how do we make this distinction between the part of us that's scared and the part that's not scared? And what we start to learn is that that is our consciousness, our awareness, our unique human gift of being able to witness our own existence. And so if you look closer at that, you go, oh, well, that's interesting. If I stop and listen to every sound I can possibly hear for 5 seconds or 10 seconds, I can then see myself doing that. I can see myself listening. And if I feel what my clothes feel like and my body and the temperature and all of that, I can see myself doing that. I can see that happening. I can even watch myself think.
Yeah, hold on. This is incredibly esoteric. The last time I had this heavy of a conversation was with John Anderson from Yes, and he's very into syncretism. And anyway, it's for the outsider, for people that don't know what the heck you're talking about, this is a real head spin.
Yeah, it is. I caution you not to use the word heavy. It's really the opposite. It's enlightening. Yeah, it's freeing. Let me try to make it a little simpler.
Please.
Then you have to follow the train of thought to the end, in terms of what is this consciousness? What's the point of this consciousness? How can we use this consciousness, this awareness that we have of our existence? If you ask somebody off the street, can you pretend that imagine in your mind that you're sitting on the top of that telephone pole over there and you could see yourself down here on the street talking to me? A lot of times people will say, yeah, and a lot of times, no. But if you encourage them, they begin to become aware that there's a part of them that can realize an awareness of their existence in the simplest terms, just seeing ourselves standing or sitting or doing whatever we're doing. And the value of this awareness, this consciousness, is that when we use words like I am scared, instead of saying that, and we realize it's a part of us, and we are then going to remember that we have a conscious or aware self that can see the difference. Then from that place of consciousness, that place of awareness, we have the ability to be able to pat ourselves on the shoulder and say to ourselves, good for you. Good for you for being able to carry on in this life in the face of your mortality. Now, mortality is helplessness. The helplessness in the face of our mortality is the thing that we're most scared of. It's the granddaddy of all the fears.
So would you say that as a result of that feeling of helplessness, that internal, some would say biological, that thing has been put in there from the beginning, sense of helplessness, that is one of the main reasons people reach out for religion? For example, I'm going to die, and there can't be anything. If you're going to tell me there's nothing after death, that freaks me out. I feel really helpless. Therefore, I'm going to hunker down into religion.
either religion or denial or any number of ways in which one can seek to understand and relate to and live with this feeling of helplessness.
Yeah.
You know, it's an important thing to also understand that our mind identifies its existence, it validates its existence by what it can do. Right? It can add, it can subtract, it can measure, it can quantify, qualify, it can witness, it can create, it can destroy, it can do all of these things. But what it can't do is it can't find the answer to our mortality.
Right.
It's helpless. And to the mind, helplessness is an anathema. It does not want to know it. It doesn't want to experience it. And so it employs what we call denial. But the fact of the matter is, if you're stuck in a traffic jam and you're late for an appointment,
you can't do anything about it.
You can't do anything about it. You are helpless. That little red helpless button in the middle of your chest or your stomach gets pushed. It might just be tickled compared to someone holding a gun to your face. You know, the horrible news from the doctor that you've got a mortal illness.
Or worse, that your wife and daughter have a mortal illness, and son, but...
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so there are all these levels of helplessness. And the way the mind learns to... The other thing the mind can do, along with quantify and qualify, is it creates systems of belief. It creates philosophy. Why does it do this? It does this because it needs to create the illusion that it has some power, that it is not helpless. So it creates religions and it creates, you know, codes of ethic and it creates ways for people to identify who's like me and who's not like me and all of that business. And real value in knowing this is that if your mind does not want to deal with helplessness and it goes into denial and it says, oh, it's my stomach or it's my head or it's a headache or that person's pissing me off or I'm stressed out or I'm anxious, we don't want to say I am scared. But when we're able to say that, when we're able to acknowledge that helplessness and our fear of helplessness is with us all the time, then we can make that choice to pat ourselves on the back and say, good for you. Good for you for carrying on. And we find compassion for ourselves. And here's where it leads. We find compassion for ourselves, and by extension, we find compassion for others. It opens our heart. So the purpose of fear is to remind us of our conscious selves from which we can find our heart, our ability to love.
Wow. I think it might be appropriate for me to go, dude.
Dude.
On the phone with Paul Michael Glaser. Paul, you I think, call yourself a cultural Jew, you know, losing your affinity of religion when you were young. Is that right?
Yeah.
What happened? Because you grew up with a pretty Jewish dad, a super Jewish grandpa, and an agnostic-y mom.
Agnostic-y, mom. That's a good word, agnostic-y. Yes, yeah. I put it simply, with whatever anxiety and turmoil that I was experiencing, that we all experience as a young person who's growing up, I didn't find that religion was answering anything for me. It wasn't filling the bill. And for whatever reasons, my genetic history or whatever, I have always found myself, you know, never settling and always questioning. So I went on this kind of long and complex journey, and I started to find things, you know, and I started to learn. And I began to understand that all religions talk about the same thing. They're all about the same thing. There's no difference whatsoever in terms of the intention or the intention of what a religion is.
But when you lost, I'm sorry to get into this, man, because you
go for it.
Okay, so you know, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and I have this long-standing argument with, if there is a God, with God, and this argument is, screw with me all you want, but mess with my kids, and I'm out of here. And here comes Ariel, and Ariel was only with you for, 7 years?
Mm-hmm.
And then she dies of AIDS. Elizabeth dies later, your wife, of AIDS. And when people go through this kind of stuff, you know, I've been at the bedside of many people who have died and been with their families, a former pastor, a hospital chaplain, etc. And, you know, I don't care who you are. You, everybody looks upwards when that kind of crap goes down. Whether it's a, I need you, or whether it's a screw you, everybody, I think, maybe I'm wrong, but everybody looks upwards in some fashion. Because the unfairness of what you went through is brutal. So during that time, Paul, did you look upward? Did you wonder if there was a God? Or were you so angry at everything that you just couldn't even, you know, fathom having a God thought?
Well, there's a few things that, a few answers to that. Yeah, first of all, primarily I was angry. I was angry. I was angry at life. I was angry at myself for being helpless. I was angry. And, you know, and I had learned to use anger as a mask for my fear, you know, from when I was a child. Mm-hmm. That's just one of the ways in which we mask our fear. We hide from it because we're so scared. I mean, look at this saying that we were raised with, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. And what I'm saying is, you know something? Fear is not a fearful thing. Fear is a gift. Fear is something that if you're able to acknowledge its existence, you can turn around into a power. Because the heart is the most powerful part of our existence and our body. So, you know, the other interesting thing is that when we talk about God, we do two things, a couple of things rather. We first of all make God into our own image.
Yeah, we anthropomorphize.
Right. So and so we right away limit our ability to understand or experience the presence of what that is. If you start to consider the possibility that everything in existence is made of thought, now we're going to get very esoteric. Sorry. Everything's made of thought, you know. You could contemplate the place where thought becomes matter. Where does thought become matter? Where does that happen? And, of course, parenthetically, when you're contemplating it, that's exactly where you are, which is called the present now. Hmm. However, when we experience what we call love, what we call God, what we call peace, what we call a sense of belonging, that is the thing we cherish most. That's what we all want most. When was our first experience of this thing, this sense of togetherness, the sense of belonging?
In the womb.
Before we were born.
Yeah, the connection we had in the womb with mom.
That's right. I mean, there's no separation whatsoever. And then we're born, and our mind, through our senses, starts to experience the world outside us. And it starts to measure it and describe it and try to control it and, you know, all of that.
We're still worth one more try.
I just thought I would totally interrupt that pre-recorded interview with Starsky. We hate doing pre-recorded interviews, and I was going to let it keep going. I realized we were running out of time, and we're kind of at the end of our show, and besides, in broadcasting, it's always better to hook you over to the next week. So we will play the rest of that interview next week on our show, just as a little treat, because that's when we start getting into the Starsky and Hutch stuff. I told him that John from Dukes of Hazzard told me one time that the General Lee would absolutely kill the Gran Torino, the red car with the white stripe, and Paul Michael Glazer had a response. Kind of had to bleep it out. We'll hear that next week. Well, that's the end of the show today, folks. Thanks for tuning in. We will, as I said, play the rest of that interview with Paul Michael Glazer, Starsky from Starsky and Hutch, next week on the Drew Marshall Show. If you missed any of today's show, including the first part of that interview, we'll put that up on our website by the end of the week for your listening pleasure. By the way, do you know who's singing? Don't give up on us, I know. We can still come through. David Soul. Hutch. The other guy. Anyway, thanks for tuning in. Really appreciate your time, folks. And we'll talk to you next week. It's written in the moonlight, painted on the stars. We can't change ours. Don't